Hello and welcome to Arts and Tech, brought to you by Our Radio and the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Chris Zhu, and in the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from The New Yorker, which is a continuation of last time, The New York Times, The Medical Futurist, and if time allows, also Gentleman's Quarterly at the end, here on Our Radio. Quick disclaimer, the information in this audio segment is not intended nor implied to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. All the content provided is for general info purposes only and does not replace a consult with your own doctor or health professional. So last time we left off on The New Yorker on a relatively long-form article about the deafblind community called Deafblind Communities Maybe Creating a New Language of Touch. And the company ProTactile, which began as a movement for autonomy and a system of tactile communication, now becoming a language of its own. And we were introduced to John Lee Clark, who was born in 1978 and grew up with something called Usher syndrome, which causes progressive vision and hearing loss. And we are sort of going through his life story and how he grew up with both, grew up deafblind, and sort of how he's navigated his entire life. And he was just speaking about his frustrations after he was married, got married to his partner Adrian, and noticed there were just some serious communication problems with his partner, who is sighted but deaf. And so just continuing on September 11, 2001, Clark went to a literature class at the University of Minnesota, where he was working towards his bachelor's degree. When he arrived, his interpreters made the handshake for airplane and raised it and ran into a raised finger twice. Clark interpreted this as an airplane hitting two poles and assumed he was hearing about a local news story, perhaps about a hobbyist in a prop plane hitting telephone wires. It wasn't until he got home that he learned how much he must have missed, the tear-streaked faces, the TV footage running on loop. I heard remarkably similar stories about 9/11 and other cataclysmic news events from several deafblind people. In 2013, Clark attended a training in Minneapolis in ProTactile, a new movement that was encouraging deafblind people to reject the stigma in American culture against touch, which often leaves them cut off from the world around them. According to ProTactile's principles, rather than waiting for an interpreter to tell her about the apples available at the grocery store, a deafblind person should plunge her hands into the produce bins. If a sighted friend pulls out her phone in the middle of a conversation to check a weather alert, she should bring her deafblind interlocutor's hand to her pocket as well to understand where the weather forecast is coming from. ProTactile includes a set of practices to make tactile communication more legible. One of its creators, a deafblind woman named Jellica Nuccio, showed Clark how it worked. They sat facing each other, their legs touching, and Nuccio rested Clark's hands on her knees, explained that as she spoke, he should tap to indicate that he understood, like a nodding, a practice called back channeling. Nuccio articulated words into Clark's hands, but also directly under his arms, back, chest, and lower thighs. In ASL, pronouns are articulated as points in space. You might designate Minneapolis as a spot in the air near your left shoulder, and Seattle as a spot near your right. And then those gestures standing for the cities. Nuccio showed Clark how to indicate them as points on the bodies instead, a two-fingered press on each shoulder. It didn't feel like a lightning bolt moment, Clark told me. It was all too natural. But after the training, he noticed changes in his household. He and Adrian began using a ProTactile principle called co-presence. If she came into a room, she would brush him to let him know she was there. Before they'd sat around the table, and whoever sat next to Clark interpreted what the rest of the family said. Afterward, they began eating in informal clusters, allowing for tactile group conversations. In the years since, ProTactile has spread across the country. Today, most deafblind adults have heard of ProTactile's call to place touch at the center of their lives. Clark, who has become a leader in the movement, compared it to the Deaf Pride movement of the 1980s, where more deaf people began speaking ASL in public, insisting that hearing people gesture back. A few hundred people still use ProTactile's communication practices daily, a very small group. Still, several linguists have come to believe that, along with some of its frequent users, ProTactile is developing into its own language with words and grammatical structures that have diverged from those of ASL. I'm totally convinced that this is no tweak of ASL. Dan Brentari, one of the premier linguists of sign language who teaches at the University of Chicago, told me, "This is a new language." Clark believes that ProTactile has the potential to upend centuries of deafblind isolation. "It's an exciting time to be deafblind," he has written. "The single most important development in deafblind history is in full swing. This past December, I met Clark in an old stone building that houses some of the University of Chicago's linguistics labs. Clark is tall with a youthful face. He lives with his partner and their three children who are hearing and sighted in St. Paul. He writes poems that are published regularly in Poetry Magazine. He won a National Magazine Award in 2020 for a piece on tactile art, and has both a poetry collection and a book of essays forthcoming from Norton. When we met, I was struck by the similarity between his presence in person and the way he comes across over email. In both, he is affectionately didactic. I had assumed that he would speak through my interpreter, but he insisted that he address me directly while she watched and translated so that I could experience the feel of pro-tactile. I have a condition called retinitis pigmentosa, the visual component of Usher syndrome, which is causing me to slowly go blind. My hearing is unaffected, though. As Clark and I faced each other, our white canes leaning in a corner of the room, he kneaded my shoulders and instantly found my baseball cap, which I used as a sort of cane for my face. It saves me from slamming my head into open cabinet doors. Lots of people with Usher syndrome and RP will use these kinds of caps, Clark said. He playfully pulled it off my head and pressed it to my chest. If you want to up your game in pro tactile, then what you're going to need is to get rid of that cap and get your hands busy. The title of Clark's new poetry collection, How to Communicate, captures what has always been the central problem for deafblind people. Deafblind children living in linguistic isolation can spontaneously develop home signs that their immediate families understand. Laura Bridgman, who lost her sight and hearing to scarlet fever in 1830s New Hampshire, had signs for father, which were hands drawn across her cheeks describing his whiskers, and spinning wheel, a rotating hand. But without a wider community, home signs can't grow into full languages. In 1837, the educator Samuel Gridley Howe recruited Bridgman to attend what would later be called Perkins, the first American school for the blind, in Massachusetts. Howe had previously visited Hartford's American Asylum for the Deaf and Dumb, an incubator for what would soon emerge as ASL, but dismissed signing as little more than pantomime. Instead, he and others at Perkins taught Bridgman to write and read English using raised letters, which she quickly mastered. He relentlessly published this achievement, and Bridgman became an international celebrity. 40 years later, Helen Keller's mother read Charles Dickens' account of meeting with Bridgman and reached out to Perkins, which sent a recent graduate, Annie Sullivan, to educate Keller. Sullivan's fingers spelled English words into Keller's hands, hoping that she would slowly pick up the language the way infants pick up spoken language. The story of Keller's breakthrough, as her teacher placed her hand under a stream of water while fingerspelling W-A-T-E-R into the other, is a canonical scene in American history. There's a bronze statue of Keller at the water pump in the U.S. Capitol, and the moment was memorialized in the 1962 film The Miracle Worker. Clark has no patience for the sacred image of Keller's deafblind epiphany. There's already a word for water, he said. Keller had developed dozens of home signs with her water before Sullivan arrived, for words such as ice cream, pretending to turn the crank of the freezer, and shivering, and bread. I would imitate the acts of cutting the slices and buttering them. What Helen learned to do was to perform a stunt. Annie was attempting the equivalent of forcing Helen Keller to utter a pentasyllabic word whenever she wanted water. If you're thirsty, say ideology or specification or liability. In Keller's lifetime, other methods of deafblind communication arose. In public, Keller used the Tadoma method, in which she placed the thumb on her throat of her interlocutor and the rest of her fingers across that person's lips and jaws, a kind of tactile lip reading. There were several variations on an alphabet glove, printed with English letters so a sighted person could tap out a message, but communicating letter by letter was cumbersome and slow. Today, some deafblind people communicate orally, many using hearing aids or cochlear implants, which usually offer only partial access to speech. Tactile sign language is also used, but issues with intelligibility remain. A 1995 study found that deafblind people understand as little as 60% of a sentence conveyed through tactile sign language. Various systems have been devised to improve tactile communication. In the 1990s, Trine Næss, a deafblind Norwegian woman, standardized haptics, a system of touch signals for common words. 11 for colors, 8 for drinks. For a time, some people were like, do you support haptics or PT? Clark told me, but you can't really compare the two. It's not a Pepsi versus Coke situation, but Pepsi versus Cadillac. In 2005, Jelica Nuccio took over as the first deafblind director of Seattle's Deafblind Service Center, which offers social services to about 100 people in the region. 30 years earlier, a nonprofit called the Seattle Lighthouse for the Blind had established a program that employed deafblind people to do industrial work, and in the decades since, the city had become a kind of deafblind mecca. Nushio is 57, with long, dark hair and a bright laugh. I was ready to move to Seattle and start a new chapter. Nushio had come to sign language late. As an adolescent, she attended school in St. Louis, which taught the oralist method, drilling deaf students in grueling exercises to learn how to read lips and produce speech. I was in a feeding trough. I was like, I have degrees, people. In 1996, as Nushio was becoming increasingly blind, she went to Helen Keller National Center, a training facility on Long Island, but she felt like it was run like a prison. Nushio was disappointed by what she found at the Seattle Center. Sighted employees and interpreters dominated life there. Blindness is enormously stigmatized in deaf culture, and many of the deaf-blind people at the Seattle Center, who Nushio called the tunnel vision people, clung to their dwindling eyesight, continuing to use visual ASL, even as it grew difficult. The tactile people ate in a separate group in lunch, and were treated with pity and condescension. Deaf-blind people often use interpreters to act with the hearing-sighted world, but in Seattle, they use them in deaf-blind groups, too. Each client would speak to her own interpreter, who would repeat the message to other interpreters, who would then relay it to their clients. I didn't understand why they would call Seattle the deaf-blind Mecca when it was run that way. Yes, there are a lot of deaf-blind people here, but so what? Why is that a Mecca? The first rule they established at Seattle Center came to be called airspace is dead space. Deaf-blind people at the Seattle Center were continually left out of ASL conversations among sighted people. Now, whether you were deaf-blind or not, all communication needed to happen in the realm of touch. Garner told me that their conversations with Nushio had become so adapted to tactile reception that sighted friends could no longer follow them. To make tactile words even more expressive, the pair gradually expanded the canvas of touch to include the backs, arms, lower thighs, and upper chest. Back channeling emerged to capture what ASL speakers communicate through facial expressions. A limp hand laid on the knee could signify exhaustion. A tense grip might indicate terror. Everything was kind of clunky, and everyone was awkward with how we were using each other's bodies, Nushio said. ASL was in the mix, and it was a mess. It was a great, messy start. Nushio and Granda called their method pro-tactile, and within a few years they were holding trainings. For the most part, the sight-reliant people were set in their ways. They often arrived, found a chair, and sat down, waiting for their interpreters. I said, if you need to know where anything is, you can ask a deaf-blind person. She would take their hands, and together they touched the drinks and the snacks. Nushio and Granda encountered tremendous resistance among employees and clients at the Seattle Center. Deaf-blind people are oppressed by deaf people in the deaf community, Granda said. People who are oppressed tend to oppress others. Nushio ended up firing much of her staff, including many of her friends, but she and Granda believed they would develop a new political framework to achieve deaf-blind autonomy. The pair hadn't set out to alter the linguistics of ASL, but as deaf-blind people in Seattle took pro-tactile methods home, words began to change in their hands. Granda said they realized ASL was no longer their language. The ASL word yes, for instance, is a fist bobbing in space like a nodding head. But by touch, it felt wrong. We knew what it meant because we knew the ASL word, but it was weird, Clark told me. A head rubbing itself against the wall. It didn't make natural sense in contact space. The ASL word no, which is a two-fingered pinch, was similarly off-putting. It felt like an ostrich trying to pluck some hair off your head, Clark said. We never had a meeting to invent new words. Life went on and we had to say yes and no 1,000 times a day. In time, the community replaced these ASL words with words that felt more tactilely intuitive. Yes became an affirmative padding, and no felt like a hand swiftly erasing a message from a whiteboard. Those PT words are so simple, duh-worthy, so elegant, and they have absolutely no relation to ASL or the ASL words yes and no, not a shred in common. The ASL word vehicle is made with a hand turned to its side, so that the thumb is like a driver piloting a craft through the air. By touch, all you can feel is a pinky grazing your leg. Over time, the pro-tactile word became a flat palm driving across the lower thigh. And speakers developed ways of elaborating on these new words. Instead of describing the size of a vehicle in terms of how big it looks, Nushio and Granda wrote, the tactile word can describe a vehicle in terms of how heavy it is, or how much friction it generates on the road. The feature is more relevant to touch. To signify a large vehicle, the speaker presses a flat palm down hard on the receiver's leg. For a compact car, she used a lighter touch. Some worry that pro-tactile's intense tactile immersion could feel inappropriate, including to deaf-blind survivors of sexual or domestic violence, an objection that its creators have had to grapple with. Granda has taught pro-tactile to numerous deaf-blind people whose prior traumas made them resistant to touch. We care about survivors and want to make sure that people feel safe, Granda said. But they argue that anybody can feel comfortable and safe in pro-tactile. This is a natural form of appropriate consent built into the language that, with constant conversations, actually can bring about healing, they said. By the mid-2010s, pro-tactile had evolved from a set of communication practices into a national movement. Grando and Nuccio made Braille bumper stickers, released videos, and traveled the country giving workshops and hosting PT happy hours where locals could learn the basics. Nuccio and Grando eventually drifted apart, and Grando spent time working at the Seattle Lighthouse and teaching pro-tactile at CBEC, an annual deafblind retreat near the city. In 2014, Nuccio established an organization dedicated to pro-tactile training called Tactile Communications. Around the same time, Clark joined the pro-tactile movement and has led trainings that have reached hundreds of people. This past December, a half dozen of pro-tactile's most fluent speakers met up at the University of Chicago. They'd come at the invitation of Tara Edwards, a linguistic anthropologist who was studying pro-tactile with her colleague, Brent Tari, the language sign language linguist. By visual standards, the lab had a drab, provisional air. It was empty aside from a haphazard scattering of metal folding chairs and a table pushed against the wall. But in deafblind space, this was a comfortable arrangement, ideal for generating ad hoc clusters of tactile conversations, with no armrests or conference tables to separate people's bodies. Nearly all the deafblind people were in stocking feet. With shoes, everything feels the same, Haley Broadway, who had flown from Austin, said, I don't feel the ground. I can't feel if it's dirty or if it's rough. Earlier that year, Broadway had married her husband, who was also deafblind, in a pro-tactile ceremony. They walked down the aisle in an intertwined cluster of friends. The exchange of vows and officiant spoke in pro-tactile to both Broadway and her husband, forming a three-way conversation. Everyone at the wedding was barefoot, and the couple served sushi. We just wanted finger food, she said, something you could eat with one hand or you could stay in communication with the other. Clark walked into the room wearing a burgundy shirt. He had a co-navigator with him who joined him in interactions with the hearing-sighted world of airline attendants, cab drivers, and cashiers. But the co-navigator trailed behind as Clark strode into the room, reaching out to explore his environment. He found Nuccio, spoke his pro-tactile name into her back, two quick downward strokes, and they hugged. My interpreter put her hands on their backs, signaling her presence. This was, I realized, what I meant to be communicating in contact space. I was sitting a few feet away, but my observation was covert. It was only when I laid my hands on the group that I was actually present with them. Clark now speaks to his partner and children in pro-tactile. Jazz Erbers, who retired after 15 years working in IT because of his changing vision, saw early videos explaining pro-tactile in 2013. I was like, that's it. That's the answer to my life now. Today, he leads pro-tactile trainings across the country. At Rochester, Rhonda Voigt Campbell, a 49-year-old instructor at the Rochester Institute of Technology, attended a residential training in pro-tactile after she became increasingly blind and felt the full possibilities of conversation return. I ate at the dinner table with several deaf-blind peers in the dark, hands and feet patting, groping, and stomping. Since the pro-tactile conversation that I observed all passed in a flutter of movements that I didn't understand, Clark took a moment to demonstrate a word, oppression. He took two hands and pressed them down onto mine. I tried to repeat it back. Is this oppression? PT isn't a code where two hands pressing down equals oppression. It'd also be something like this, he said, and dragged his hand slowly down my arm. This person is oppressed, he said, and gripped my chest, crushing something invisible there. He cycled through a range of other movements. My interpreter became uncharacteristically overwhelmed. I can't think of enough English words to equal what he's giving you, she said. At first, I interpreted Clark's demonstration as suggesting that pro-tactile lacks precision. But each variety of oppression that Clark had shown me, which my interpreter scrambled to translate as repression, suppression, and so on, intuitively connoted oppression. They were all forms of dragging, weighting, gripping. It's just that they had no direct correspondence with English. Unlike with spoken language, which can be transcribed or taped, or visual sign language, which can be filmed, there's no way to make a tactile recording. This means that the only way to communicate in pro-tactile is in person. At one point, graduate students demonstrated new devices that could send taps and presses from a distance, kind of a primitive haptic FaceTime. But the deaf-blind group was unimpressed by the tech, which could transmit only slow single taps on a limited patch of the body, and in none of the rich array of squeezes and presses that pro-tactile deploys. Today, many deafblind people stay in touch using a Braille display, which has dots that pop up and down to render text from a computer or phone. I'm learning to use one too. Navigating cluttered web pages can be nightmarish in Braille, but the deafblind world thrives in the plain text realm of email listservs. In lieu of LOL, pro-tactile emailers type LOY for laughing on you, invoking the pro-tactile mode of laughter, a spidery tickle. Clark teaches college-level seminars entirely by email. He once wrote, "Before PT came along, I had my most fun, found the most joy, experienced life the most on listservs." In 2006, just as the pro-tactile movement was beginning, Tara Edwards, then a graduate student, was at CBEC, the annual retreat near Seattle. Outside, she saw a deafblind person forcefully correcting her interpreter. "This was highly abnormal," Edwards said. "I could tell that was a shift in the authority structure." But Edwards was also interested in the correction itself. The interpreter had pointed at something in the air, and the deafblind person, with some degree of angst and irritation, told her to instead draw a diagram on her palm. People had pretty strong opinions about whether or not you were doing it right. To me, that suggested there was some kind of system at play. Edwards spent the following years filming some of ProTactile's most fluent speakers, telling stories and describing objects, and found an increasingly conventionalized system, with an emerging lexicon of its own, organized by new phonological rules. When Edwards shared these rules with deafblind people, they knew exactly what she meant, even if they'd never had a reason to spell it out. Just as English speakers are able to follow complex grammatical rules without having any idea what a definite clause is. By 2014, Edwards believed that among those who immersed themselves in ProTactile, the practice was ever evolving into its own language. Other linguists I spoke to agreed. Molly Flaherty, a developmental psychologist and a sign language linguist at Davidson College, told me, "How amazing is it that language is something that's flexible enough to work in yet another modality?" In the 1950s, the linguist Noam Chomsky